This Dharma talk is given today on October 16th, and its title is, roughly speaking, Women and Zen. The source material I'm using is a book, Zen Women, with a subtitle of Beyond Tea Ladies, Iron Maidens, and Macho Masters. We're all familiar, actually, with those particular groups of ladies in through teishos and attending sesshins and so forth. It's written by a woman named Grace Shirison, so I'm going to read her bio. She is a Dharma teacher in the Suzuki Roshi lineage, empowered by Sojourn Mel Weitzman, Roshi, abbot of the Berkeley Zen Center. She has also been empowered to teach koans by Keido Fukushima Roshi, chief abbot of Tofukuji Monastery in Kyoto, Japan. Grace is the head teacher of the Central Valley Zen Foundation and has founded and leads three Zen groups and a Zen retreat center in California. Grace is a clinical psychologist who has specialized in women and families. She has been married for 41 years and has two grown sons and three grandchildren. Much of her source material also comes from a scholar named Miriam Levering, who is a professor at the University of Tennessee in religious studies and Asian studies. And her present focus of study is translation of the letters of Zen master Da Hui, pronounced actually now Da Wei. Some of the most interesting material here comes from Da Wei and his work. He was lived from 1089 to 1163, and he is credited with being the Zen master in China who brought the practice of breakthrough koan Zen to life at a time when silent illumination or shikantaza was the primary practice, although koan practice was also used at the same time. But Da Wei is the master of that. And who knew that Da Wei's very first student who came to awakening was a woman, and that his first Dharma heir was also a woman? I certainly didn't. Some of you here who are more deeply have studied women in Buddhism more deeply will, of course, know many of the things I'm bringing to light today, but there we go. I was a little concerned about the accuracy of some of the source material in this book, so I emailed Andy Ferguson, who's the author of Zen's Chinese Heritage, the Zen Masters and Their Disciples, and the leader of the tours to China, and was the leader of the tour that we took last year from the Zen Center. And so I just read his brief response. He says, "Thanks so much for your email. I'm rushing to leave early with a tour this morning in China and can't answer it right now, but I'll try to give you a brief one. I haven't read the book on women teachers yet, but some have, and I'm not sure if the research there is accurate. As other people told me, a few things I know to be not quite right. No matter. Of the 7 or 8 teachers I've been most impressed with in China, at least 4 are women. Hui Gong is one. She's the abbess that we met on our trip, and I'll speak of her later. And the abbess of Moshan is another, and we will meet her today. In my view, it is women who will make Zen survive in the West if it survives. Men have made a hash of the tradition in many places. I'm Chinese in my thinking, and I believe we must ultimately re-embrace the home-leaving tradition, all while making a teaching lay tradition that does not exist in the East. Women will lead this if it is to happen." Now, for the men here, please relax. You are very... you are very dear to me, and this is not an anti-man talk at all. It's simply trying to let us know about some of these really inspiring and amazing women who are known, actually. I mean, we chant at the end of the ancestral, we chant, and to the unknown women, centuries of enlightened ones. Actually, I think that's a problem. It's not that they were unknown, it's they're unrecorded, the centuries of unrecorded women. So I was talking to Amala Sensei about this, and her suggestion was that we might consider changing it to unsung women, but we'll have to talk to Roshi about that. Anyway, so this is a really material about the unsung women, the unknown women, and so we'll go, and we have to start out with the very first woman, she wasn't in Zen, but the very first practitioner that we hear of, which is the Buddha's stepmother, Maha Prajapati. She, after the Buddha's great enlightenment, remember, she was the second wife of King Suddhodana, the Buddha's father, and his mother died right after giving birth to him, and Prajapati raised him. So basically, as any of you know, if you've ever adopted a child from birth, it's your child. So the Buddha was her son, to all extents and purposes. And after his awakening, she and many of her people who followed her, she had herself was very devoted and wanted to follow the way. And so she goes barefoot to 150 miles to ask the Buddha if they can start an order. And I'll just read this from the book. During the Buddha's lifetime, Maha Prajapati, the Buddha's aunt and later his stepmother, expressed her wish to join the Buddha's order along with her numerous followers. When the Buddha refused her plea, she repeated her aspirations to Ananda, the Buddha's cousin and close disciple. Ananda tried three times to gain the Buddha's permission and was admonished by the Buddha's third refusal. Enough. Ananda struck out. The rule was that any seeker could make only three identical requests, but he did not give up. Instead, he asked the Buddha if, in fact, women could attain enlightenment. Of course, the Buddha had to said yes, of course they can. So on that premise, Ananda was able to persuade the Buddha to allow women to practice and to form an order. But he established some very kind of punitive rules about women's involvement. Now, in wondering about this whole matter of the Buddha's refusal to allow women, we weren't there. We don't really know what his motives were or what he was... or even if the words that are reported of what he said at that time are even accurate. But it is a source of anguish for a lot of women that this refusal, given that there is no gender in awakening, the true mind has no, true nature has no no differentiation, no between genders or anything else. So, at least at one level. So this was a great mystery. But he set up these eight special rules that a nun of even of 100 years standing shall respectfully greet, rise up in the presence of, bow down before, and perform all proper duties towards a monk ordained even a day. Well, if you think in places like China or even in Asia where monks might be admitted as teenagers, that's a little bit hard to take. A nun is not to spend the rainy season in a district where there's no monk. And every half moon, a nun is to await two things from the order of monks, the date of the communal confession and the time monks will come to give teaching. And after the rains retreat, the nuns are to hold pavarana in respect to what has been seen and what has been heard and what has been suspected in front of the monks and the nun sanghas. And a nun who's been guilty of a serious offense must undergo discipline before both sanghas, that of the monks and the nuns. And when a novice has trained for 2 years in the 6 precepts, she should seek ordination from both sanghas. A nun is not to revile or abuse a monk under any circumstance, and admonition of monks by nuns is forbidden. admonition of nuns by monks is not forbidden. So though these eight rules became the foundation for nunneries and caused a lot of problems, because now the women's orders were reliant on men's orders to keep going. But in spite of that, in Zen, there were women who were able to study alongside men in monasteries, and they were not obviously treated that differently. And some of those eight special rules were clearly broken to allow that to happen. And because Zen does not rely on words and letters, this was, I think, a little, and the freedom of it was a little more likely to allow for that to happen. In fact, the transmission of Buddhism from India to China was, of course, carried by male monks, but the transmission from China to Japan came via Korea, and Korean nuns who brought originally the first Buddhist practitioners from Korea were three women who came from Korea to Japan. So women were in fact within this whole Zen lineage. There we have the women showing up in key places. But in China, in the Song Dynasty, one of the emperors declared he was getting bothered by the intermingling of the dependence between nuns and monks, and so he declared that from then on, monks would do their own thing and nuns would do their own thing. So the ordination process stayed intact in China in a way that it hasn't in the rest of Asia. And so that's why these days you have abbesses in Chinese monasteries who are descendants. For example, Mo Shan was a very famous Zen teacher, and her nunnery is still in function. And as Andy Ferguson remarks, the abbess there is a very fine master. Of the nuns who practiced, you would find many different kinds of practices that they did. They might be facilitators or founders of temples. They, if they were wealthy and were from rich families or had education. You have to remember that women were not, in these olden times, were not educated. So many of the women who entered nunneries couldn't read or write. Whereas in the male monasteries, the teaching of children was quite prevalent. And so maybe this is why there isn't so much source material from early women teachers, because there wasn't such facility with the written word. But there were the founders, there were supporters of temples, there were convent nuns, there were those who practiced with men, and we'll talk about some of those. And there were family nuns, and there were working nuns. So all of these varieties of practice really, I think, speak to the condition today where we have, in the West, largely a lay practice. And how will we manage that as time goes on will be interesting to see. Of the early Zen teachers, we do know of a couple of them, this woman, Mo Shan Liao Ran, the first full-fledged female Zen master. And we don't, as is very typical of these women whose names are mentioned, we know nothing of their early life, their life as women, what led them to practice. But her status is quite unquestionable. And here's a little little dialogue from her. Um, One day the monk Guangshi Xian arrived at Mount Mo, where Mo Shan taught, and said, "If there's someone here who's worthy, I'll stay here. If not, I'll overturn the meditation platform." Slightly arrogant fellow, wouldn't you think? He was going to come and tell her what to do. He then entered the hall. Mo Shan sent her attendant to query the visitor, saying, "Your reverence, are you here sightseeing, or have you come seeking the Buddha Dharma?" "Oh, I seek the Dharma." So Mo Shan sat upon the Dharma seat in the audience room, and Xian entered for an interview. Mo Shan said, "Oh, your reverence, where have you come from today?" Guangshi said, "From the road's mouth," in parens, Shirasan says, "an undefiled place." Mo Shan said, "Why don't you cover it?" In parens, that mouth. Guangshi didn't answer for some time. Finally he asked, "Well, what about Mount Mo?" Meaning you, Mo Shan. Mo Shan said, "The peak isn't revealed." Guangshi asked, "Who is the master of Mount Mo?" Mo Shan said, "Without the form of man or woman." Guangshi shouted, then he said, "Why can't it transform itself and become a man?" Mo Shan said, "It's not a god or demon, so how could it become something else?" Guangshi then submitted to become Mo Shan's student, and he worked as head gardener for 3 years. So that's a really good example of a really fine Zen teacher. In fact, the Bodhidharmas of his first four heirs, one was a woman, which is referred to, but it's not very very obvious in her name was Zongqi, and I'll just get to her. John looked in amazement at my little tags, and maybe he was right, because it's hard to find my way through them. Well, we may just, yes. Anyway, she was one of the first four of Bodhidharma's disciples, and he said that she had his flesh, but we don't know anything about her. And then we come to one of the most interesting ones, Dawei's first Buddhist woman. I'm going to read here about this one. In Song Dynasty China, 960 to 1279, the number of Buddhist nuns included in the census in the year was 61,239. The number of Buddhist monks was recorded as 397,615, creating a male-to-female ratio of 6.5 to 1. Yet of those, very few nuns are remembered, and of those who are, there are even fewer teaching records. Surely, out of 61,000 nuns, a few must have offered some deep teachings. Dawei, a widely acclaimed Zen master of this era, and himself the successor of the great Song Dynasty Zen master Yuan Wu. Yuan Wu, by the way, was the compiler of the Blue Cliff Record, which we use as the second of the koan collections, and he's very, very well known in Zen literature. Yuan Wu was recognized as a national teacher and received purple robes from two emperors. And Da Wei came to study with Yuan Wu after broad exposure to various styles and school of Zen. His understanding blossomed under Yuan Wu's training, becoming so profound that Yuan Wu fully shared his teaching responsibilities with him. Da Wei was sometimes compared to old master Lin Qi himself. He learned to teach koans from Yuan Wu, and he also learned to work with female students. Yuan Wu had several female Dharma heirs and was a strong supporter of women's practice. Who knew that? Unfortunately, while we know their names, the records of his nuns and their teaching words are not extant. Like Yuan Wu, Da Wei also designated female Dharma heirs when he began to function as an independent teacher, and we have the good fortune to know something of their life history. So then, in particular, the nun Miao Dao was Da Wei's very first Dharma heir, female or male, and the first person to experience awakening under his guidance. The teaching relationship between them had a significant impact on him and the teaching style he used throughout his lifetime. Through his relationship with Miao Dao and her subsequent awakening, he gained confidence in his methods. He recounted teaching her and how her awakening unfolded through their interactions. Da Wei's other famous female Dharma heir, Miao Zhong, was memorialized by one of Da Wei's head monks after she bested him in Dharma combat. And we'll read that one too, because it's really a great story. So, Miao Dao was a Zen prodigy who fulfilled the promise of her ability by training with Da Wei. According to Miriam Levering's account of her life, she was born into an influential and politically successful family, and her father's position most likely helped her gain access to training with well-known teachers at Zen monasteries. Her father was both intelligent and practical. He agreed to her Zen training only after he had carefully observed the seriousness of her calling. As a child, she lost interest in worldly pleasures and would sit quietly contemplating, seemingly forgetting herself. Her father carefully observed her remarks and actions to see if there was the slightest contradiction between her words and actions. He seems not to have found any, and when she reached the age of 20, she was allowed to ordain and receive the nun's ordination robe. After ordination, she practiced actively at several Zen temples before meeting Da Wei. Her most significant early Zen relationship was with Qing Liao. Qing Liao was an elder Dharma brother of Hongzhi, the teacher who became an inspiration for the Japanese founder Eihei Dogen, and really the founding of the Soto line of Zen. So here we have Miao Dao studying with Qing Liao at his monastery, and it was in those days, the masters would go around teaching and they would be invited to give a talk at a different monastery. And so while she's there in an Ango period, which is a period of serious study and meditation, Da Wei comes in 1134 and he gives a lecture. And he talks, of course, about the true nature and how it's possible to see it in this lifetime. And Miao Dao was just broken apart, and she decided that she had to go try to study with Da Wei, and she broke her commitment to the Ango. It's like, you know, saying in the middle of Sesshin, okay, I had enough of you, Roshi, I'm off to, I'm going to go study with a Soto master, you know. A very big upheaval for her and for her teacher too. So off she goes and she asks Da Wei to allow her to teach. And this is what she said in her request to him. And it's reported as a spoken speech. She says, "Recently the senior monk Miao Dao came from Shuifang and asked three times to enter my chamber for instruction, saying it is because, quote, death follows life and with terrible speed, and the samsaric cycle of birth and death is a matter of great urgency. I am not yet clear about myself, and therefore I wish to beg for instruction." From this dialogue and his later response, we learn details of the intimate inquiry and relationship between student and teacher. Da Wei accepts her request and puts her worry in perspective. We can only imagine Miao Dao's turmoil when she decided to change boats in midstream. A senior and committed practitioner, she left her teacher, broke her commitment to the practice period, and set out to follow this newer, less established teacher, Da Wei. Many practitioners know firsthand how doubt and distraction may arise upon entering a silent retreat, but for Miao Dao, there was additional uncertainty in changing meditation methods. For many meditators, the cacophony of thoughts and feelings that arise in the midst of a meditation retreat can seem overwhelming, despite a deep commitment to settle the mind. We are often surprised, having come to the retreat to deepen practice, how the monkey mind tries to assert itself. Miao Dao was suffering guilt and regret, as well as anxious anticipation of her new training. Shorten this. Dawi helped Miao Dao see the way-seeking mind within the morass of her personal resistance. He underlined and focused the importance of bodhicitta, her aspiration to practice unselfishly. He helped her to see through her fear and highlight her strength. She had bodhicitta. And bodhicitta itself was her strength in her journey, something upon which she could rely. We can feel his strong faith in her aspiration, just as he surely did. I think this bodhicitta is something that is this giving sense of wanting to help others. I think it's hardwired maybe in women quite significantly. It comes out of nurturing, raising children and protecting families. And it's a good source of inspiration for us women as we practice, is to recognize that giving nature and that sense of loving that can be used not in a weak way, but as a pouring forth of what we have as hard wiring, so it can't be dislodged. It's right there, and to use that sense of giving and bodhicitta as a way of practicing. It's a contrast to the driven way we often approach Zen. You know, oh, I've got to come to awakening. I got to do that. You know, and this and the intensity of Sesshin can be helped by using this innate sense of bodhicitta. It's not to say that men don't have it too in equal measure, but it's in a different. It has a different edge to it, I think, because of women's birthing and sustenance of family. Just one more little bit on Dao Wei. How he trained Miao Dao in koan meditation. Here is his instruction to her on working with her koan practice. Quote, I raised Master Matsu's, it's not mind, it is not Buddha, it's not a thing, and instructed her to take a look at it. Moreover, I gave her an explanation. One, you must not take it as a statement of truth. You must not take it as something you do not need to do anything about. Do not take it as a flint-struck spark or a lightning flash. Do not try to divine the meaning of it. Do not try to figure it out from the context in which I brought it up. It is not mind, it is not the Buddha, it is not a thing. After all, what is it? Same instruction given really today for people working on koans, mu or hu or whatever, face. So there we have, she comes to awakening, and she was certified as a teacher by Dao Wei, and we can follow her teaching career through several chapters. She became abbess of a nunnery in her hometown and later moved to two other convents, finally settling in Jingzhu Nunnery, where she died. Technically, no Dharma heirs are listed for her, although Jingzhu was recognized for its Chan women's lineage, and Dao Wei mentioned a number of women who trained with her. And you can read recorded teishos from her in this document, the Lian Teng Wei Yao. So for those who are interested. And then let's go to his other rather startling woman named Miao Zhong. Miao Zhong's bold behavior and quick wit have endeared her to practitioners from her own era through contemporary Western Zen. From Song and Ming Dynasty China through Kamakura, Japan, she has been venerated by nuns who learned of her encounter with Wei Nan, the head monk at Dawei's monastery. In her most famous teaching encounter, she vindicates the vagina. She extracts it from the Buddha's blazing hot charcoal pit and mouth of a poisonous black snake. Women were kind of regarded as problems for monastics because of the temptation. And you know, sexuality is an important part of this whole matter, and it's not looked at very much. Of course, you can avoid it if you separate monks and nuns, and monks never have to touch a woman or deal with it, but it's there all along. And so at some point, looking into the whole issue of sexuality and how it relates to practice and how it has reared its snake-like head in modern Zen in encounters between students and teachers. So, but that's another subject and not one I would wish to take on myself at this moment. We can appreciate Miao Zhong's originality when we learn a little of her life circumstance, her training as a daughter and wife of an upper-class family. She was born to an educated and politically successful family. She had a natural awakening as a teenager. While quietly contemplating the great matter, the meaning of human life destined to death, she had a profound insight. She had no idea that her experience was out of the ordinary. She just assumed that her understanding was universally known. Miao Zhong's famous encounter with Wei Nan, wherein she vindicates the vagina, was first discovered and translated by Miriam Levering. Anyway, I think we'll leave that little bit out there. She was known to Yan Wu as well. And she was eventually ordained and attracted many followers. But then I'm going to read this encounter with Wei Nan. See, here's the problem. If a woman wanted to study with a male master, she couldn't live in the monastic quarters because very often they were like, as they are in Japan, they'd be a sleeping platform, and the monks did everything within the one area. And so it was customary that the abbot would have guest quarters close to his, that where he resided, and that visiting teachers and presumably also female practitioners could stay there. But this could raise some questions among the monks. Well, what's the master doing with a nice, pretty woman there, you know, some blah, blah. So, and as you know, in monasteries or in any community, gossip is quite prevalent when you're allowed to speak. So, the murmurings regarding, you know, what Da Wei was doing, it's also because I think Yuan Wu had maybe some reputation. He certainly appreciated women followers, and so it wasn't an unusual thing for Da Wei to also be open to receiving women. But it really bothered Wei Nan, and as the head monk, you know, head of Zendo, he felt he was obliged to check it out, make sure things were okay. So, here we go. Wei Nan relied on Da Wei and served as his senior monk, the head monk of the Sangha Hall in which the monks in Chan training lived and studied. Before Miao Zhong had become a nun, Da Wei lodged her in the abbot's quarters. The head monk Wei Nan always made disapproving noises. Da Wei said to him, "Even though she is a woman, she has strengths. Wei Nan still did not approve. Da Wei then insisted that he should interview her. Wei Nan reluctantly sent a message that he would go. Miao Dao said, will you make it a Dharma interview or a worldly interview? The head monk replied, a Dharma interview. She said, then send your attendants away. And she went in first and then called to him, please come in. When he came past the curtain, he saw her lying face upward on the bed without anything on at all. He pointed at her genitals and said, you have to give him some credit for holding his whatever together. and he said, what kind of place is this? She replied, all of the Buddhas of the three worlds and the six patriarchs and all the great monks everywhere, they all came out from within this. Wei Nan said, and would you let me enter or not? She replied, it allows horses to cross. It does not allow asses to cross. Wei Nan said nothing, and she declared, the interview with the senior monk is ended. She then turned over and faced the inside. Wei Nan became embarrassed and left. Da Wei said, it is certainly not the case that the old beast does not have any insight. Wei Nan was ashamed. So we can see that she really had, she took control of the meeting, and she a pretty amazing encounter, really. Grace says here, she answered Wei Nan on the entire Buddhist history that condemns women and their vaginas as sexual traps for aspiring monks. This is the place through which all Buddhas and patriarchs and all monks everywhere come out. We can hear her unstated meaning. Hey, monk, if you have a problem with my vagina, tell me where would you get the Buddhas and monks you need for your beloved Zen practice. Anyway, you know, that's Grace giving her interpretation. We don't really exactly know, although this is a written record, and it is used, it's still, this particular nun is revered in Japan by the nuns there as an example of someone who really overcame the tendency to revile women and to put them down and so forth. There isn't time, really. I didn't intend to just stick with a couple, but those are so so startling that I thought we should certainly hear about them. And then there were other very important nuns in Japan. They often were, the founding nuns were, of course, women of some repute and either married to a shogun or they had connections with the emperor. And there are two temples in Japan that are worth mentioning. One of them, Hokkeiji, which is was provided orphanage and help and care for disadvantaged people, and was the abbess there, founded a pharmacy, and she had a bathhouses for the poor, and it said that she would even dress the wounds, the sores of lepers. So you see this, the strength that these people had in spite of the mores of the time. And then Tokeiji, which is another monastery, which gave refuge to women who, prostitutes or women who had been divorced, and it gained recognition even from the emperor as a place where divorces could actually be granted through this. Nuns would stay there for 2 years, and then they would get a paper which declared they were kind of free of stain, and they could go back into everyday life and not be marked as, you know, rejects. And that practice of allowing divorce went for 600 years, And it was only in 1873 that the laws of the land changed and allowed for divorce to be granted through the constitution or whatever, the parliamentary system there, and so that it was no longer a function of this temple. So, and of course, Korea had a huge tradition of training nuns, and all through the Japanese occupation, there were nuns who continued to practice. So this is a very rich, rich tradition. Of course, nowadays there are many more women ordained, especially in the Soto line. And so this is going to change things a lot in bringing Buddhism here to the West. In our trip to China, we did meet this other woman, abbess that he mentions. Her name is Hui Gong. And we met her. She is at the second ancestor, Weka, or Waco, as he really should be pronounced, at Waco's Dharma seat. She is a fireball, just a delightful, joyful, probably doesn't stand more than 5 feet, and she just like floats around. She's full of energy. And she and her nuns, she has 12 nuns there, and they took over this old Dharma seat of Waco's that had been left to neglect and had been occupied by the army since the time of Mao. And it took them 3 months to clean it out, and they raised all their own vegetables. We had lunch there, and the most incredibly good lunch, and but the chilies were just like hot, just so fiery, just matched her spirit so well. They had a tree there that was, maybe somebody, Martha, you might correct me, but I think it was 4,000 years old, this dragon tree. Do you remember? Yeah, but a very, very old tree, which they say came back to life and started to sprout a few leaves after the nuns cleaned everything up. And that nunnery will become the seat of a very large temple. They were building it while we were there. It's going to be vast in memory and honor of Waco. And she is an inspiration, and she would love to have some women practitioners go sit with them. And Andy's working now on a different way of tours, less sightseeing and more practice in monasteries, and I would think that this would be very inspiring. The Dharma hall of that nunnery, they couldn't afford a Buddha figure, so they just had a kind of a computer printout, huge. I can't remember whether it was a Guanyin or a Buddha. But anyway, that's what they had. But they had piles of zafus there. But they were all really pretty. They had sort of, they were silk, and they had lotuses on the top. And I just think it's a little sort of slight difference there, a little softening. And obviously were very well used. Everywhere we went in that region, there were a lot of lay women. You were just joyful, very, very eager. And one wonders if the one-child policy in China hasn't freed up a lot of women of middle years to devote themselves more to practice because they don't have so many family responsibilities. But that's just conjecture. I asked Andy about that, but he didn't have time to answer. But alongside all this, these beautiful zafus, the piles, there on the wall were the ancestors, and Empty Cloud, who was very, very famous Chinese master who died in the 50s and was the founder of many, many of the temples. And then at the closest to the door was this Hui Gong's teacher, a really fierce lady. She looked like any of our great-great-grandmother's pictures, with black, and she just beady eyes staring straight out. So she was no pushover, probably more like one of the, like Mo Shan or Grindstone Liu. But this was very vibrant. And so it goes on, you know. It's not something that belongs to the past. And here in the United States, I mean, we have this tradition that is a male monastic tradition. Andy actually did say one thing that I think is interesting. I'll just read that last paragraph he wrote again and a little addition. In my view, it is women who will make Zen survive in the West, if it survives. Men have made a hash of the tradition in many places. I'm Chinese in my thinking, and I believe we must ultimately re-embrace the home-leaving tradition, all while making a teaching lay tradition that does not exist in the East. Women will lead this if it is to happen. So I'll just leave that opening there. Where will Zen? It's only 100 years here. I think all of us who practice deeply know that you need the retreat time, whether it's going to Sesshin or sitting time really on the mat. This can't be done without this periods of internal silence and effort. So you can't just, you know, have an entirely lay tradition that doesn't involve the deep introspection. But how it goes forward here is very interesting. Now, you know, most families, both parents have to work. Kids have lots of things to do. There's not much money. All the pressures are forcing a lot of rethinking on how do you get the balance? How do you have the yin and yang equal sizes? How do we do that? Where do we go? We're focusing a little more now in this center on Sangha, and that's the third jewel, as Roshi mentioned in his Teisho a few weeks ago. And how does that unfold? I don't know. But anyway, in honor of our wondrous ancestress women, there are many, 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 many more in this book. It's an interesting read. Some of it's a bit repetitive, the way it's formed, but it certainly is worth looking at. There are many other books, and if people have questions about women in Buddhism, then I wouldn't presume to know very much, and I would defer to, if there are questions, to Amala Sensei, who's looked into this much more thoroughly in a scholarly way. So I'll open it up now for a few questions, and then we're really out of time, 5 minutes.
Errol, I just wanted to say that it's very inspiring to hear this aspect. It's inspiring for men, for myself, as well as women, I'm sure. And thank you for bringing it up.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Yeah.